Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, a product of the Health Policy Research Consortium, a CTIS program, your weekly podcast empowering communities to use policy as a vehicle to improve their health and learn how to mobilize your community to create positive change where you live, work, and worship. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast.
Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell, and today we're going to be talking about the opioid crisis and epidemic in the Mid-Atlantic region. And joining me is Mr. Byron Soji Thomas, the Deputy Director for Health Policy Research and Analysis at the Health Policy Research Consortium, also known as HPRC. Mr. Byron Soji Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patricia. Welcome back.
So much is going on with this opioids crisis, and I'm sure by now everyone has heard about opioids, but may not fully understand what they are and all the implications surrounding them. So let's start off by identifying and defining what are opioids.
Opioids are a class of drugs, so they are usually prescribed to treat moderate to severe pain. It's a naturally occurring compound. You'll find it in the opium plant from Asia, but you can also make it in the lab. So you have a situation now where there are people who make opioids in a lab, an opioid like fentanyl, which a lot of people have heard about, which is sold on the street and is causing all kinds of trouble. But anyway, opioids, legal opioids, lawful opioids, are usually for treating pain. And so you would have opioids like oxycodone. So the brand name for that is OxyContin. A lot of people would have heard about that. Hydrocodone, the brand name for that is Vicodin. A lot of people have heard about that. Morphine is an opioid. Methadone is an opioid. So those are all different kinds of opioids used to treat pain usually.
And so how are people getting addicted to the opioids?
A lot of people are getting addicted because it is prescribed, the opioid is prescribed by a doctor to treat pain, as I said. It is very effective for treating pain. So somebody comes out of surgery, you need to treat that kind of pain. Somebody has cancer, you need to treat that kind of pain. Somebody is in a bad car accident or in a bad fall at work, you need to treat that kind of pain. The doctor prescribes the opioid for the pain. The opioid is so effective, the patient keeps taking it, sometimes even after they've managed the worst of the pain, and then it becomes something that is an addiction that continue.
And so we've been having pain for a very, very long time. Why does it seem like now it's become an epidemic?
A number of factors. People who are taking opioids for pain, once they get addicted, can now find other ways to replace the lawful prescription that the doctor gave them. So maybe they might doctor shop. They might take a fake prescription and shop around for doctors who might prescribe it if they're not careful. Or they might get it from the medicine cabinet at home, family member or friend, steal it from them or buy it from them. Or they might just buy it from an illegal dealer on the street, an illicit dealer who wants to sell an opioid that is inexpensive, like the people who buy heroin on the street. Heroin is an opioid. So now people are making heroin that is way more effective than heroin, way more addictive than heroin used to be back in the day. And it is inexpensive and people can afford it. And it can give some people a higher high than the heroin back in the day. And now people are even creating opioids like fentanyl that they lace the heroin with so that the high is even more intense and can addict people even quicker.
And so what are the health effects of opioids?
Well, these addictions can ultimately lead to organ failure that causes overdoses. So if you take too much of it, it overwhelms the receptors in your body that are supposed to numb the pain and can eventually lead to failure of your heart and failure of your nervous system and brain problems, which ultimately can lead to you collapsing. And then, you know, once you're addicted, there are all the symptoms that go with addictions, including the concentration and the memory problems and your ability to to focus on tasks and all the other things.
Well, you're hearing about the opioid problem in the news. Just how bad is it in the U.S.?
Oh, it's very bad. According to 2016 numbers, 42,000 Americans died from opioid overdoses, and about 40% of those were from prescription opioids. It wasn't like you bought it from the guy on the corner. About 40% of those were from prescription opioids. The number of opioid deaths in 2016 was about five times the number of opioid deaths in 1999. We now know that about 11 million Americans abused prescription opioids in 2016. It's epidemic. It's everywhere. It's all over the country.
So what does that say to you when you read statistics that 42% of the opioid deaths are related to actual legal prescriptions?
Well, it seems like it's a problem that we should go back and understand. So part of the understanding is doctors and first responders and policymakers and lawmakers are trying to understand how is it that the problem is starting there at the prescription drug level. And so, as I said, pain needs to be treated. But the question is, when the opioid is first prescribed, is it prescribed at too high a dose? When it is first prescribed, is it prescribed for too many days at a time? Can we find a way how you can prescribe just enough to manage the pain and not enough to addict people? And so this is the central question that needs to be asked. But now we're dealing with a law enforcement problem as well, where we are now learning that there are drug manufacturers, lawful drug manufacturers, who are flooding communities with some of these prescription drugs. And there have been a number of exposés in the news in the last couple of weeks about how certain drug manufacturers and drug distributors would pump these prescription drugs into communities. There was one story out of West Virginia recently where over the period of about a decade, they were pumping millions of these units into a town with less than 10,000 people. And so to the extent that first we can determine how much of this is necessary to manage the pain without getting people addicted, how much of this is drug manufacturers or drug distributors trying to make an extra profit, how much of this is an education problem for the physicians that do or the dentists that do the prescribing, how much of this is a regulation problem for the manufacturers and distributors, how much of this is a law enforcement problem for a criminal who wants to make a buck, how much of this is an economics problem for people who are getting into opioids because of other things in their lives that are not going well.
And then there's also the other factor, and correct me if I'm wrong, that even though the doctor may prescribe how many pills the person can take, the person may feel like, well, the pain isn't subsiding, so let me take another pill or a half a pill. Is that a contributing factor as well, you think?
That may well be a contributing factor. Again, part of what we need to do to solve the problem is understand all of these factors. We can ask these questions, but the explosion of the problem is pretty recent, so we don't have all the information we need to answer all the questions.
In the Health Policy Research Consortium, you primarily focus on the Mid-Atlantic region, which you call Region 3. Tell us what states comprise of the region, and then let us know how bad it is, the opioid crisis is in the Mid-Atlantic region.
So Maryland, the District of Columbia, Virginia, Delaware, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. And the problem is bad here. Out of the five worst affected states in the United States, number one and number four in our region, West Virginia and Pennsylvania. And so it's pretty bad here. And all the state and county governments in the region are hard at work trying to find ways to solve the problem. So, for example, in Maryland, there was a 58.9% increase in deaths from these opioid overdoses from 2015 to 2016. That's a one-year jump of 58.9% in the overdose deaths. In Delaware, it was a 40% jump in overdose deaths from opioids from 2015 to 2016. In the District of Columbia, was 108.6% increase in overdose deaths in that same period, 2015 to 2016. In that same period, 34.7% in Virginia, 25.3% in West Virginia, and 44.1% increase in overdose deaths in Pennsylvania in that one-year period. It's pretty bad. So the state and county governments in the region are aggressively trying to look for answers and trying to solve the problem.
These are some startling statistics.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the populations that are represented in these numbers.
Well, older adults are more likely to be exposed to the prescription opioid problem than younger people. By older people, I mean 40 years and above, right? So the younger people are more likely to be exposed to the problem on the illicit side where they buy it from the dealer on the street. Women are more likely to use prescription opioids than men are. Whites are more likely to use the prescription opioids than Hispanics, but there's no significant difference between Hispanic and black people. And then the numbers are higher in some states than in others. There are differences, but it's a big enough problem in all populations for lawmakers and policymakers to look for answers for everybody.
So how are public health authorities responding to this opioid problem in the Mid-Atlantic region?
They're trying to deal with it at both ends, at the demand side and on the supply side. So first, what's causing it? And on that side, the prescription drug side. So why are prescribers, that is physicians and dentists and people who prescribe these medications, why have they prescribed so much of it? And how did it get out of hand? As I said, did they prescribe too high a dose at the outset so that the patient gets addicted quickly? Or did they put the patient on it for too many days at a time? So in the States, they're looking at passing laws that say if you're prescribing an opioid, you can only prescribe it for 5 days at a time, 7 days at a time, 14 days at a time. Or you should only, like in Maryland, you should only prescribe what is necessary to treat the pain, keeping a keen eye on what could cause problems if you don't do it. They are looking at ways to teach prescribers, train prescribers into prescribing more responsibly. So they'll take them through a course where they sign up for the course, and then they take a course about prescribing these opioids and the effects that they could have and how it could modify their behavior, and then check to see if the change after they get out of class results in fewer of these prescribed or fewer people dying from overdoses as a consequence. They are tracking how many of these are prescribed. So when the opioid is prescribed, the pharmacist who dispenses it is supposed to enter the information in the database so we know who got prescribed, how much of it, for how long. And then the state authority can check that at the back end. But for many of those, they're called prescription drug monitoring programs. Most of them don't have a mandatory amount of time between which you can enter the data. So it's all on an honor system. You know, most states don't specify how often you should enter, if you enter it right away or within a week or within a month. But the expectation is there that when the pharmacist dispenses it, that he should enter into the database. So there is a review, a periodic review by the state to see how much data is in the database. And then the criminal justice interventions as well, such as asking first responders to take people who are suspected of having an overdose to treatment instead of taking them to jail. And then when overdoses happen, training first responders to administer a drug called naloxone, which can reverse the effects of an overdose and save lives. So there are many different ways that people are looking for answers and trying to understand what the best way is to solve the problem.
Well, let's talk about public policy, the public policy aspect of this. What are the most promising public policy solutions to this opioid crisis?
The first block of policy responses are the state or the nation or the county deciding we need to help prescribers change their prescribing behavior. So the state can either pass a law that says when you're prescribing an opioid, prescribe it for this many days and pass a law that says that, or pass a law that says don't prescribe too high a dose, or pass a law that says use the prescription drug monitoring program, enter the data at specific intervals, and we will check it at specific intervals and track it, or pass a law or a policy or a guidance that says every first responder should have units of naloxone in their ambulance or in their prowl car, or pass a law that says we should take a more public health focus than a law enforcement focus. That is to say, if we're out on the street and we find somebody who was affected by an overdose, our focus is to get that person into treatment rather than getting that person to jail. The idea behind not just data, but managing the amount of information people have on an awareness and a public health education standpoint, making sure the public knows what the dangers are. So those are some of the policy choices that policymakers need to make.
Yes, to standardize the approach altogether, I'm sure will be very helpful.
Yes, to the degree that standardization can yield fruit, yes. We don't know as much about how much standardization can help, but the more each county or each state can understand their particular needs, the more they can tailor the approaches to what they need.
So what is HPRC's response to the opioid crisis?
Well, so far, we have been trying to figure out if there's anything we can do by way of a research study to understand the problem in the region. So it's all in the planning stages at the moment. But right now, we've been thinking about, can we do a study to understand prescriber behavior? So can we do a study where we ask, well, a state passes this law that all their prescribers should go through this prescriber education for opioids. Well, are those making a difference? And we're thinking that's probably what we want to understand. So that's probably where we're going to go. But we're still in the planning stages and we're still talking to people and looking at the literature that's available so we know what's known, what's not known. But that's probably the direction we're going, prescriber behavior.
And are you looking to collaborate with certain groups in the region?
We've spoken to a couple people. We've had some good feedback. So, yeah, I mean, we're talking to a couple of our partners, and we've gotten some positive responses from them. So hopefully we're able to put something together.
And what do you believe the future holds for the opioid crisis? I mean, do you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
The light is the urgency that the devastation has caused. That's the light. The light is people understanding that now this problem is so bad. Opioid overdoses are killing just about as many people as car crashes, just about as many people as gun violence. And because it is now at that level where the numbers are comparable to gun violence, and I think it's in some age groups, I think it's already past the amount of deaths we get from motor vehicle accidents now in some places. So the urgency of the devastation is the light now. So that urgency makes all the policymakers stand up and take notice and realize that we need to throw everything we can to solve it. So the light at the end of the tunnel is policymakers also hearing from communities that they must stand up and do something. And the fire that communities will light underneath the policymaker, that the individual citizen can go to the policymaker and say, my community is devastated by this. There was a story we saw in the press recently about first responders going to the same home four times in the same day. When situations become that urgent, you know, Dr. King used to talk about the fierce urgency of now. There is a fierce urgency of now to deal with the problem. And so because it is so widespread and because so many communities are involved and because so many powerful and influential people are impacted by the crisis, people who actually have influence and power to affect and change the situation for the better. And because there's enough heat underneath policymakers and because enough people are affected by this, the light is that much attention to the problem will lead to everybody coming together around a table and saying, okay, what do we understand about the problem? What resources can we throw at it? How much data can we collect so we know if we're being successful? How much can we do? How many lives can we save today that we couldn't save yesterday? That's the light at the end of the tunnel.
And you've been talking about what things can be done outside of the individual, but help us to wrap it up by letting us know what we can do at the individual level when we have loved ones who are trying their best to manage pain and they have to take opioids to do that. What can we do for our loved ones?
On an individual basis, the first step is the conversation with whoever is prescribing. If it's a doctor or a dentist, you did a root canal, you had dental surgery, or the surgeon prescribes after you have surgery. When you see the prescription, you read, the name might be unfamiliar to you. Doctor, what is this? Doctor, is this an opioid? Doctor, is this the best dose you can give me? Is it a dose that can help me manage pain but not put me down the road to addiction? If you forget to ask the physician, when you go to fill it out, and you get to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy comes to you with a white coat, and you say, Mr. or Ms. Pharmacist, this is what I was prescribed. It is a pain thing. I've been hearing about all these opioids. Is this an opioid? This is the dosage. What do you think, as far as the dosage, is it something that I should go back to the doctor and ask them if this dosage is appropriate? Have a conversation like that. And then if you are the caregiver and you're not the patient, have the conversation with the patient. How do you feel? Should we go back to the doctor and talk about how you feel after you take this? If the course that the prescriber has prescribed the medication for, if you have run the course, if they say, okay, I prescribed this for you, take this for a week and come back to me. If the week is over and there are a couple of pills left in the bottle, find a way to properly dispose of it. After you've spoken to the physician, okay, we've treated the pain is gone. How do we dispose of this? So it's not lying around and nobody is tempted or has any ideas, or you don't get somebody who has a problem come to your house that rifles through cabinets looking for something. Find a way to properly dispose of it if you're done. If you're not done, the conversations just need to continue. You need to keep talking to the doctor and the pharmacist, and you need to make sure that you protect loved ones from the leftovers in your cabinet. Just pay attention to what's going on in the news, and you know, if there are problems in your own community with it. Some communities, like I said, this story from a couple of weeks ago about the first responder going to the same house to treat the same person for overdose four times in the same day. If you're in a community where the problem is that bad, if you're hearing on the news that a lot of people have been dying of overdose in your community, trying to figure out what the authorities in your community are doing about it and trying to see if you can help contribute to the solution. It's an awareness thing. Everybody just needs to be aware. Everybody needs to be awake. Everybody needs to be paying attention. That's it.
Yeah, and do your research on your own, too. Absolutely.
And especially if you are the patient and somebody prescribes an opioid for you, you need to understand as much as you can before you take it. You need to pay attention to your own body while you're taking it. You need to be willing to have a conversation after the medication has run its course and you've taken all you need to take. And if there are any leftovers, you need to dispose of them properly.
Absolutely. And all prescriptions come with a data sheet, a fact sheet, information sheet that tells you about all the symptoms and things to look out for. I'm sure many people do not read them, but you definitely want to read that information.
It's useful. The more you know, the easier it is for you to prevent problems down the road.
Great. Is there anything else you want to say as we close out?
Well, thank you for asking these questions, and hopefully our listeners will be better informed from having spent a few minutes with us. And there's plenty more information about this. If you go to the CDC's website, that's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So you go to cdc.gov. There's a search engine. When you open up the first page, type opioid in it. It'll open up a page. The CDC keeps a whole bunch of information for everyday people. You don't have to be a scientist. They have it there in language you can understand. All the things you need to look out for, you open it up, they'll tell you what to look for.
Thank you so much. You've shared some incredible information and very startling statistics about opioids, this crisis, and how it is affecting each and every one of us. So thank you for joining us, Mr. Byron Soji Thomas, Deputy Director for Health Policy Research and Analysis at the Health Policy Research Consortium.
Thank you, Patricia.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. Remember, you have the power to use policy to improve your picture of health where you live, work, and worship. For more information on the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, visit our website at www.hprc.info and like us on our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr.
The research and information that we report during this show was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD008-60802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.